toxic disasters. What do those who have gone through nuclear accidents and government dealings in the aftermath have to share with people in East Palestine, Ohio, where a toxic train wreck 2 weeks ago released deadly chemical toxins into their community? More than you might imagine, as the parallels are both telling and worrisome. So when one veteran anti-nuclear activist, someone who has faced the aftermath of Three Mile Island and other radioactive disasters, cautions those whose lives have been shattered by the East Palestine toxic train wreck, and he tells them,
"Will there be follow-on health studies? Probably not. There often are not. I mean, there really wasn't at Three Mile Island, except for the efforts of individuals, often members of the public, who are not even trained in the field, but they train themselves after the meltdown. What people need to do is protect themselves and their family as best they can, force the train company to help these people to relocate. Who wants to leave their home? That's heartbreaking, but for your health and for your safety, you might have to. Document everything you can. Don't let them tell you you're crazy, and stick together as a community as best you can."
And there is much more. When Kevin Camps, radioactive waste specialist for Beyond Nuclear and a veteran of battles against nuclear toxic waste, reaches out to survivors of the East Palestine, Ohio chemical toxic train wreck and alerts them to necessary actions that concerned citizens need to take in the immediate aftermath, you know that deadly toxins come in many varieties, and that we who fight against nuclear toxins have a lot to share with those to whom these issues are new, as they learn about the dangers of that seat that, unfortunately, in different flavors, we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a look at the commonalities shared between nuclear concerns and the toxic train wreck in East Palestine, Ohio, where a shipment of poisonous chemicals literally went off the rails on February 3rd. And now local citizens have to deal with health concerns as well as government and corporate attempts to manage their fears and diffuse the implications of this disaster. We talk with Kevin Camps, who points out how this accident parallels anti-nuclear concerns and illustrates the dangers that would be inherent in attempting to ship highly radioactive waste via rail, as is currently being proposed. He also provides suggestions for survivors in East Palestine as they deal with government and corporate attempts to manage their fears and diffuse the implications of this disaster, just like they do after everything that goes wrong with nuclear. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world. Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Numbnuts of the Week for Outstanding Nuclear Boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than Bing Chatbox Artificial Intelligence will ever provide to we mere humans. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 21st, 2023. And here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting in the U.S., where here in California, a late-hour attempt to extend the life of Diablo Canyon, California's last nuclear power station, has run into a problem: shortage of time. A state analysis predicted it will take federal regulators until late 2026 to act on an application to extend the operating run of Diablo Canyon. The problem? The plant is scheduled to be shut down permanently by mid-2025. Operator Pacific Gas and Electric has made a request to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for an unprecedented exemption that would allow the 40-year-old reactors to continue making electricity while the NRC reviews the application, not yet filed, to extend the licenses for as much as 2 decades. According to Diane Curran, an attorney for the anti-nuclear advocacy group Mothers for Peace, there is absolutely no precedent for the exemption requested by PG&E. The NRC has never allowed a reactor to operate past its license expiration dates without thoroughly assessing the safety and environmental risks. Among these risks is potential shaking from nearby earthquake faults that were not recognized when the design was first approved. In New Mexico, opposition is growing to prohibit the federal government building a nuclear waste repository on their land without state consent. Momentum against New Mexico becoming a permanent dumping ground for the nation's nuclear waste, including spent fuel from commercial power reactors around the country, is growing. So what is the federal government doing? It's adding financial incentives for states reluctant to host storage of nuclear waste. In January, the Biden administration put up $26 million for communities interested in studying potential interim storage sites. But as State Senator Jeff Steinborn, sponsor of a bill banning a facility without state consent, said in an interview, "I don't think any amount of money would convince me that it's the right thing to do." And on the website, we'll have a link to an article where a former Department of Energy nuclear security official says that Bill Gates' TerraPower's plans to build its Natrium Reactor Demonstration Project in Kemmerer, Wyoming, is not safe. Many details here, that's why we're linking to it. In Japan, the government insists that it will be releasing 1.3 million tons of radioactive tritium-contaminated water into the Pacific Ocean, claiming that it is safe, without defining the parameters by which they rule this contaminant is quote-unquote safe, and despite increasingly intense pushback from the governments of South Korea, China, and the Pacific Island nations. A recent survey conducted by Japan's Yomiuri Shimbun revealed that 93% of South Koreans are concerned over the safety of food from the Fukushima region. 87% of Chinese respondents in this survey also expressed concerns over food from Fukushima, and even 36% of Japanese residents felt it would be unsafe to eat anything produced in the area. And this before the radioactive water release. And just so you can visualize this, 1.3 million tons of radioactive water is the equivalent of the water in 500 Olympic-sized swimming pools. And a simulation by South Korean government research institutes has found that if Japan dumps contaminated water from the Fukushima nuclear reactor into the Pacific Ocean, tritium, the radioactive isotope of hydrogen in the contaminated water, will begin entering the waters off South Korea's Jeju Island within 4 or 5 years. The radioactive wastewater would then move in an eastward direction due to the strong Kuroshio current. It would lead the water to the west coast of the United States and then continue to spread through the northern parts of the Pacific Ocean. Tritium can decay to helium-3 and affect DNA, which could result in adverse effects on the human body, including cell death or deterioration in reproductive function. And there are other radionuclides in the water which have not been taken into account as to how it would spread through the food chains or the effects of their accumulation in water. And speaking of nuclear safety in Japan, here's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
As you've heard many times on this show, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has been urging his ministers to assuage, meaning appease or calm down, public concerns over the government's planned policy shift that will allow the operation of nuclear power plants beyond the current limit of 60 years. Not resolve the issues, just damp everybody down. During the recent vote, in a rare move, one of the 5 commissioners remains opposed to the policy. And where did that opposition voice come from? Akira Ishiwatari, who is the commissioner in charge of earthquake and tsunami countermeasures. He said, the revision is not based on new scientific or technical findings, and it cannot be said to be a shift to the safe side. But hey, just because this guy is in charge of managing the risks that would result doesn't mean that anyone is going to pay any attention to him. And that's why, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numb Nuts of the Week.
As Russia's war on Ukraine hits its one-year anniversary, here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
A year ago, I was invited by colleagues at International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War to participate in an online panel anticipating the humanitarian risks to populations in Ukraine should Russia invade. A few days later, Russia did just that. My role was to look at the risks posed by Ukraine's 15 operational nuclear reactors and the closed but still dangerous Chernobyl site should they become caught up in a war. Last Saturday, the same panel reconvened to have another look. One of the questions that was asked was, is the situation more dangerous now than a year ago? Our response was a unanimous yes. My colleagues tackled the issue of the horrendous consequences to civilians already from the war itself, and the even more horrifying outcome should nuclear weapons be used, as Russia has several times threatened to do. I revisited the nuclear power risks, which I also did a few episodes ago on this podcast. But since then, new dangers have emerged. The Russian-occupied six-reactor Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in the southeast of the country relies on a nearby reservoir for its cooling water. But the water level at the reservoir has been dropping dramatically, potentially compromising access to essential cooling water for the reactors and fuel pools. Who is draining the reservoir? It makes no sense for either side to risk a meltdown, but it's happening on the Russian-occupied side of the Dnipro River, so the best guess by experts is that it is a military strategy by the Russians to flood land and prevent Ukrainian troops from advancing. Then, just a few days ago, two cruise missiles were seen flying dangerously close to the South Ukraine nuclear power plant. A mishap with these would have an unthinkable outcome. And just last weekend, the head of Germany's Federal Office for Radiation Protection, Inga Paolini, sounded the alarm about the growing risk of a nuclear power plant disaster in Ukraine due to fighting or loss of power, while lamenting the lack of attention being paid to these dangers. Paolini said an incident at one of Ukraine's nuclear power plants would have, quote, far-reaching consequences as long as the war continues. And yet, she pointed out, this danger already seems to be receding into the background of public awareness. Indeed, it has been a consistent pattern in the press not to take nuclear power risks seriously. Instead, the media publishes story after story planted there by a well-orchestrated worldwide nuclear industry campaign about the benefits of expanding nuclear power. Dr. Ira Helfand, who addressed the nuclear weapons dangers on the IPPNW program, pointed in conclusion to an old motto of Physicians for Social Responsibility, the organization's US chapter, who, in the context of nuclear weapons, said, if there is no cure, then we must choose prevention. Ukraine's 15 reactors, when all are running, which right now they are not, are responsible for providing 50% of the country's electricity supply. Since they are too dangerous to operate if embroiled in a combat zone, what else, asked one of our viewers, can Ukraine do to meet the needs of its already suffering population, especially now in freezing winter temperatures? The answer was to be found in that lesson on nuclear weapons. Right now, for Ukraine, there is no cure. You cannot make nuclear power safer, and like any country that rashly chose to rely so heavily on nuclear power in the first place, Ukraine does not have enough renewable energy backup to fill the gap. Nuclear power plants are a liability in war. They are a liability under the conditions of the climate crisis. They are not going to be there, in fact, cannot be there, when the public needs them most. So the cure is to learn that lesson, to replace the nuclear power plants we have and ban any future use. I'm Linda Pence Gunter, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat, and that's this week's Hot Story.
Also in Ukraine, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of that country strongly condemns the blocking by the Russian Federation of the rotation of experts of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to the temporarily occupied Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Russian occupying forces also continue to militarize the Zaporizhia plant and the surrounding area, actively deploying military equipment and servicemen. This move by the Russian Federation grossly violates the norms of international law, undermines the norms of nuclear and radiation safety, and demonstrates complete disregard for the resolutions of the Board of Governors of the IAEA, which demand that Russia immediately withdraw military equipment and Russian personnel from Zaporizhia. Meanwhile, it has just been learned that Russia has moved more than 600 of its troops onto Zaporizhia's physical plant, where they are staging for deployment into the region. In France, the new Hinkley Point C nuclear reactor is being built by French state-owned energy utility EDF, and it's now likely to cost almost 30% more than its last budget estimate, almost £33 billion, or $40 billion. It is likely that EDF's financing partner, China's CGN, will not put any more funds into the project. That means EDF would have to step in to shoulder the additional costs, and EDF is in the process of being nationalized by the French government. The company last week reported a record net loss of 1.7 billion euros, which is the same as $19.1 billion. In all of this, the financially flailing EDF is still targeting a start date for Hinkley C of June 2027, but warned that there was risk of a further 15-month delay if government-imposed lockdowns or the war in Ukraine disrupts supply chains. At the same time, EDF Renewables, a subsidiary of nuclear giant EDF, has bought one of the biggest proposed offshore wind projects in Australia, cutting their losses. Playing both ends against the middle? If they're buying up wind farms, why is EDF still front and center on nuclear builds? And finally, the African Commission on Nuclear Energy is working to promote pan-African adoption of nuclear energy, and Morocco has just endorsed it. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, nuclear weapons, reactors, uranium mining, radioactive waste, accidents, permissible radiation exposures. The list of nuclear dangers and disasters is as endless as plutonium, which remains dangerously radioactive for 240,000 years, yes, a quarter of a million years. Despite the known risks, this industry perpetuates itself, making obscene amounts of money while threatening the future of the planet and of life itself. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat is here, to help you understand what's going on in the nuclear world and what you can do about it. We're dedicated to giving you the nuclear stories you can't find in mainstream media, and we provide them on an ongoing basis so that you have both context and continuity and can get the full picture. We cover not only what the industry is doing, but how brave activists around the world are fighting back, and how any one of us, yes, even you, can take action towards stopping the nuclear madness. But we need your help to keep doing this work. Here's what you can do right now. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and help us with a donation of any size. You can also set up a recurring donation for as little as $5 a month. That's what you would spend on a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. So if you value in-depth reports on nuclear issues, like the ones that you get on Nuclear Hot Seat, do what you can now. NuclearHotSeat.com, red button, follow the prompts. And know that however much you can help, that you are listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. On February 3rd, 2023, a Norfolk Southern train derailed near East Palestine, Ohio, a town of about 48,000 people near the border with Pennsylvania. About three dozen cars derailed, 11 of which were carrying hazardous materials. It released five rail cars worth of vinyl chloride, a chemical which can wreak havoc on the human liver, Worse, the railroad then chose to intentionally burn off this material in a controlled explosion, or that's what they called it. But with heat, vinyl chloride can be converted into phosgene, a highly toxic gas that was made illegal after World War I. As one resident said about this accident, "This is our Chernobyl." While the materials on board the train were not radioactive, they still provide evidence that supports concerns of those who oppose nuclear, especially the proposed shipping of nuclear waste materials by train to the proposed so-called interim storage facilities in the American Southwest. There are other parallels as well, and to find out more, we spoke with Kevin Camps. He is radioactive waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear. Kevin specializes in high-level waste management and transportation, new and existing reactors, decommissioning, environmental and public health risks associated with government and industry efforts to dump commercial irradiated fuel rods on Native American lands in the western United States. We spoke with Kevin Camps on Saturday, February 18, 2023. Kevin Camps, thanks for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for having me.
When you first heard about the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, and the resulting spill of highly toxic chemicals, what were your first thoughts?
Well, I emailed my colleagues in Ohio and Pennsylvania right away because it was clear it was a major rail disaster. And I pointed out that Nuclear Information and Resource Service, every time there was a rail disaster of any scale, they would ask, what if high-level radioactive waste had been on board? So I just pointed this out to my colleagues in that neck of the woods. And, you know, here we are weeks later, and this rail disaster is still unfolding as we speak. So it really begs the question, what if radioactive waste had been on board that train? I mean, it's bad enough, the toxic chemicals, believe you me, it's bad enough. But it really emphasizes our warnings that date back for decades about mobile Chernobyl, this phrase that Michael Marriott at NIRS coined back in the 90s, which really turned into our biggest tool in our toolbox in the fight against the Yucca Mountain dump back in the day, because it made it everybody's problem across the country. When it comes to radioactive waste transportation, we all live in Nevada. Only updated to now, we all live in Texas. We all live in New Mexico, because these issues are just as applicable to consolidated interim storage facilities as they are to Yucca Mountain. Only with consolidated interim storage, you are doubling the transportation risks automatically by definition, because if it's interim, then it's going to move again. So it makes no sense to move it somewhere just to move it again for no good reason. These transportation risks are off the charts bad, and how many rolls of the dice are you willing to do with this most deadly material?
What struck me were the parallels between how this disaster was unfolding and government response and the like, and what I've seen in nuclear situations at various periods of time after something actually happened in the nuclear world. As you watch the actions and statements of the government and Norfolk Southern Railway in the immediate aftermath of the disaster, which is only 2 weeks old at this point, how much of their response pattern was familiar to you from what you've seen after something nuclear happens?
Well, I mean, Governor DeWine in Ohio, how can you trust him? I mean, he's implicated in the bribery for bailout scandal involving First Energy Nuclear. How can he be seen as a trustworthy voice? And it's interesting that even the governor of Pennsylvania is calling the company and Governor DeWine into question as to their actions. I mean, this incident's right on the border with Ohio and Pennsylvania. It's on the Ohio side, but it's very much implicating Pennsylvanians. So yeah, there's throwbacks to Three Mile Island with Governor Thornburg. How can you trust the elected officials? How can you trust the companies? You know, there's real questions about this so-called controlled burn, which is a real kind of Orwellian phrase. They control burned the vinyl chloride in immense quantities. And there was one environmental toxicologist who was kind of distraught in the press coverage in the New York Times about how much vinyl chloride was burned.
at this disaster site. And so there's questions now, why did you do that? Was it to clean up the tracks more quickly so that freight can roll through more quickly so you can get back to business and making money? What are the implications for health and environment? These are questions the governor of Pennsylvania is asking at this point. So there are real parallels. I mean, you know, in corporate America, there are public relations models for emergency situations, for disaster situations. And I'm sure they are being rolled out. And the same is true at the federal agencies. I mean, there's real questions being asked about the Environmental Protection Agency's assurances to the public that everything's fine. We're checking the air in individual homes by the hundreds. There's questions being asked by environmental toxicologists. What kind of monitors are you using? Because if you use the wrong detector, you won't detect what's there. People are smelling the toxic chemicals on the air. People have symptoms from rashes to burning eyes, and the list goes on. And there's already a half dozen lawsuits that have been filed, some involving that so-called controlled burn, which I believe the quantity was 1.1 million pounds of vinyl chloride. I'm not sure it was all controlled burned. And the whole rationale for the controlled burn was to prevent an uncontrolled explosion that could throw shrapnel into the community. So why wasn't the community simply evacuated to an adequate distance so that shrapnel would not be an issue? Of course, the chemical warfare agents, for lack of a better phrase, that are involved in these environmental releases, people should be moved way far away from this scene. It's going to travel with the wind. It's going to travel with the water. Why did they move people back in, declaring it safe so quickly? It also goes back to 9/11 and EPA Administrator Christine Todd Whitman declaring ground zero, air is safe, which probably has cost hundreds of emergency responders either their health or their lives since that false statement of assurance by EPA Administrator Whitman was put out there in 2001 so that Wall Street could get back to business. That was the main motivation. And then what did she do after she left the federal government? She went on to become a lobbyist for the nuclear power industry. So I guess at least she's consistent.
The damage that has been done already and continues to unfold from this disaster will go on for years, if not decades, if not beyond that. We know that from what we've seen in the nuclear industry, because when there's a problem, it happens, but it never stops happening because damage has been done and must be lived with in the aftermath. For example, I had Eric Epstein of Three Mile Island Alert on a few weeks ago talking about the battles that are still going on to clean up Three Mile Island, 43, almost 44 years after the accident happened there. What might the ongoing fallout, you should pardon the expression, from this particular rail disaster and toxic release hold for the residents of that area and the surrounding areas?
Well, some of the toxic chemicals that have been identified are extremely hazardous. Vinyl chloride has really gotten a lot of the attention. One of the lawyers involved in the lawsuits pointed out that vinyl chloride, a carcinogen, causes mutations of human DNA. And so he made the point that exposure, even in these first 2 weeks, I think the controlled burn was on day three of the disaster, so that was 11 days ago, could already have initiated cancer genesis in people who have been exposed. So that's going to be devastating in individual lives. It could be devastating for generations to come in this community. That's the human impacts. There's also wildlife impacts. I mean, one of the more heartbreaking stories I've come across is that there's a Eastern Hellbender restoration project in the area, right in the middle of all these fish kills. So hellbenders are 2-foot-long salamanders when they're adult, and they're extremely endangered in Ohio. They're very sensitive to pollution. Their skin is how they breathe underwater in these streams. And so any pollution in the streams is going to hurt them. And this much pollution could be the death knell for the species in Ohio. And they're just amazing. They're 2-foot-long salamanders in the Appalachian region of our country. There's just such heartbreak on all kinds of levels here.
There were also reports of pets having died and 3,500 fish were found dead in the local area. That was as of a story a few days ago. many of these are the kinds of problems that show up after there has been a nuclear accident. And let's shift this a little bit to more specific nuclear issues, because as you spoke of earlier, there are two so-called supposedly interim nuclear waste storage sites that are being proposed, if not actually built, in West Texas and right across the border, about 35 miles away in New Mexico. They are proposed to take in the radioactive waste from every nuclear reactor in the country, and that would require transport. What is being proposed as transport, and talk about the problems that we have with it?
Well, just to give folks an idea of the scale here, I mean, Yucca Mountain was 70,000 metric tons of high-level radioactive waste proposed for burial in Nevada, so transport there. These two consolidated interim storage facilities in the Permian Basin of Texas and Mexico would be more than three times the amount of waste that was proposed at Yucca. So that means either three times the number of shipments or three times the quantity being shipped. I mean, what the industry has done in the last 20 plus years is to greatly increase the size of the shipping containers. So back 20 plus years ago, the biggest containers for moving irradiated nuclear fuel on trains could hold 24 pressurized water reactor fuel assemblies. These days, it's up to 37. The whole tech design called the UMAX can hold 37 pressurized water reactor fuel assemblies. So it's 50% bigger than the biggest containers 20 years ago, which means it's that much heavier. That's a big issue on the degraded infrastructure of the United States, the degraded rails. These are going to be some of the heaviest loads moving around by the thousands if these companies get their way. It's going to take a tremendous toll on the infrastructure. Could be the cause of the accident, could be the cause of the derailment. So these consolidated interim storage facilities, the two companies, Holtec in New Mexico, Interim Storage Partners in Texas, they're talking about mostly rail shipments. There could be some heavy haul truck shipments involved. These are monster trucks and sometimes in back pusher trucks with trailers with 200 wheels in between, because there are reactors in this country that lack direct rail access. So you got to get from the reactor that lacks rail to the nearest railhead if you're going to use these giant rail-sized containers. So one option is heavy haul truck. They go 3 miles per hour. They got their own issues. Another option that doesn't get talked about much, I've got my Great Lakes shirt on here, is barges. So barge shipments on the Great Lakes, specifically on Lake Michigan, barge shipments along the California coast from Diablo Canyon to Oxnard. You name the neck of the woods in the country, there are barge shipments proposed. So that brings up a whole different category of risk. If one of these containers were to sink underwater, whether on a barge shipment or plunging off a bridge into a river, what could happen is not only the releases of high-level radioactive waste into that surface water, but water going into the container, serving as a neutron moderator. If there's a critical mass formed in the fissile material still in the container, uranium-235, plutonium-239, it could spark a nuclear chain reaction inside the container on the bottom of the surface water, which would make emergency response a suicide mission. Because if they did pull the container to the surface of the water, anybody on board that boat with the crane on the boat would be exposed to very high level neutron and gamma radiation as the container approached the surface of the water. The releases would be even worse into the surface water as well, because now you're generating fresh, highly radioactive waste, inadvertently, accidentally. But these inadvertent criticalities can often prove fatal. We saw that in Japan in September of 1999 when two workers were killed at a fuel fabrication factory. Another was badly injured, but so too were hundreds of local residents exposed to the off-gassing of radioactive particles and gases that inadvertent criticality emitted into the local environment. So that's some of the risks involved in barge shipping. You know, a rush job can be really dangerous, and that's what these consolidated interim storage facilities represent. The companies haven't backed down from saying, they have said that they could open in 2023, which is kind of far-fetched at this point, but Texas has a license. They got their license in September of 2021. So they very well could
could try to build this thing and start shipments. It's hard to say how quickly they might move, but next year is not beyond the realm of possibility if they decided to really go for it. We would fight them as best we could. We were recently ruled against in the DC circuit, the second highest court in the land. All opponents to the interim storage partners facility in Texas were rejected by the three-judge panel in Beyond Nuclear's case for a hyper-technicality during the NRC licensing proceeding. Specifically, as we would corner them on the illegalities of their proposal, they would alter their application. The NRC would accept the alteration and move forward with the licensing proceeding. So unless we adjusted our paperwork accordingly at every twist and turn, we were found in the wrong because we didn't adjust our paperwork adequately to keep up with this moving target of a proposal. The judges didn't want to hear about the violations of major federal laws like the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. They said, because we didn't keep up with our paperwork filing, they didn't want to hear about these supposed violations of federal law. So we're in a much better position on the Holtec federal appeals in New Mexico, because back then, years ago, it was the lead proposal. Texas was way far behind back then. The roles have reversed since. So we used to prioritize Holtec because it was the most immediate danger. But now Texas is the most immediate danger. So we're still very active on our federal appeals. We're really confident that the Holtec appeal, they can't get us on that same hyper-technicality because we didn't make that mistake in the New Mexico proceeding. But we'll see how it goes. NRC could license Holtec in New Mexico as early as the end of March. And then our federal appeals are ripe for judicial consideration. Again, we're before the DC circuit, but there's other circuit courts involved. In fact, the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans has yet to rule on the Texas dump. And we're very hopeful that the state of Texas and Fasken Oil will prevail in that New Orleans, which would put the brakes on the Texas dump as well.
We've been talking about the possibility of accidents happening to nuclear waste as it's being transported. What about intentionals? What about the vulnerability to bad actors, be they domestic terrorists or the foreign ones, to do something to create a problem with the nuclear waste as it's being transported?
Yeah, another slogan Mary Olson and years came up with some years back, dirty bombs on wheels for these shipments. So very much so. I mean, the State of Nevada Agency for Nuclear Projects, we really owe them a debt of gratitude for their tremendous scholarship on these questions. They have been a leader in studying the terrorism and sabotage risks of high-level radioactive waste shipping. They've done study after study. They've looked at the weapons that are available on the international black market so that even terrorist organizations could set up shop in a place like the south side of Chicago and wait for the U.S. federal government to bring the high-level radioactive waste to them to then attack with anti-tank weaponry, for example. So there's tremendous gaps, to put it mildly, in the security on rail shipping in this country. I mean, an example would be a colleague of mine at Greenpeace in Washington, D.C., took a Wall Street Journal reporter on a tour of the amazing graffiti to be seen in Washington, D.C. on the walls inside train tunnels in Washington, D.C. The point being, and folks have probably seen graffiti on trains, that means graffiti artists have access to these train tunnels and to these trains. If you see a train with graffiti, a graffiti artist had access to that train, and it was not legal. It was trespassing, and it could even be vandalism or whatever other charges you want to levy. But so too would attackers have access, just like graffiti artists would have access. So there's a real vulnerability. The thing is, though, you don't have to be that close to a train to use an anti-tank weapon. They are designed to be fired from distances. These don't have to be suicide attacks. They could be remote attacks. And these containers were not designed to withstand anti-tank weaponry. The thickness of high-level radioactive waste shipping containers is for radiation shielding purposes, so that the workers that have to approach very closely or the people who live along the routes aren't exposed to even worse doses of gamma and neutron than they already are. Some does emanate out. It's 10 millirem per hour at a distance of 2 meters, 6.6 feet. That's allowed. That's 10 milligram per hour is 1 to 2 chest x-rays per hour at a distance of 6 feet. That's what's allowed. It can be worse than that because there's quite a history in the US and overseas of externally contaminated shipments that are emitting much higher dose rates of gamma and neutron. And that one of the partners and interim storage partners is Orano of France. And they've had one of the more infamous external contamination scandals in France in the 1990s. One shipment was 3,300 times permissible because of the external contamination. So now you're talking not 1 to 2 chest x-rays per hour, you're talking 3,300 to 6,600 x-rays per hour at a distance of 2 meters. So those are incident-free shipments. They just happen to be contaminated, or incident-free shipments that aren't, that are still emanating hazardous radioactivity to people who are close enough to it.
Whether the containers are leaking or not, there's still radiation coming off of them. And there is the danger of interference from outside sources. I have seen maps of the proposed transit routes or the presumed transit routes for taking the radioactive material down to, be it West Texas or New Mexico. For the communities that live along these routes, do they have any recourse? Can they put forth a protest? Can they in any way work locally against this national campaign to bring mobile Chernobyls through their communities?
Well, the city of Las Vegas passed a local ordinance that any high-level waste transported through its city limits would be a crime. And the mayor at the time, Oscar Goodman, said he'd be the one slapping the cuffs on the train engineer or the truck driver. So there are local municipalities willing to put up a fight. And interestingly, the Department of Energy has never taken that to court to say, you can't do that, Las Vegas. Interstate Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution says we can move these commodities across state lines anytime we want to. They didn't want to raise the profile of Las Vegas's resistance, so they never challenged it legally. I think resolutions at the local level or at the state level, it all makes a difference. The more resistance that's generated, the less likely they're going to move this stuff through your community. One highlight for us recently was the city of Fort Worth, Texas, which is going to be heavily impacted by these consolidated interim storage facility shipments to either of the dumps, which are so close together anyway. They joined us with a friend of the court filing in our federal appeal against the Texas dump. And we're hopeful that they will do so again against the Holtec dump coming up. If you look at what few maps are available from the companies themselves, they've tried to keep the routing as secretive as possible. They've learned the lesson from Yucca Mountain. Don't let people know this is coming through because people are going to rise up against it. So there's one map in each of the applications from these companies that shows only 4 reactors in the country accounted for. They're almost identical maps. Somebody plagiarized somebody else, but the only difference being the destination point, which is already so close together. So it shows Maine Yankee and it shows San Onofre, California. 3 reactors at San Onofre, 1 at Maine Yankee. That's 4 reactors out of 131 in this country. The other 127 are not accounted for on this map, but they say it's bound, so that's okay. If you study the maps, what few maps have been provided by these companies, it shows shipments from Maine Yankee, which is a closed single reactor site in Maine. 60 containers of high-level waste would pass through a dozen or more states to get to these consolidated interim storage facilities in the Permian Basin. They would pass through a city like Fort Worth to get there. And then what the maps show is these companies are assuming, and NRC is complicit in this, that the wastes, because it's interim, it's not permanent, they have to be exported somewhere someday. They're assuming Yucca Mountain, which is its own outrage, that the NRC would be complicit in assuming Yucca Mountain. They're supposed to be the objective, unbiased judge of the Yucca Mountain license application. Apparently, they've already made up their mind before the licensing proceeding has taken place. So anyway, those export shipments from interim storage partners in Texas and from Holtec in New Mexico would pass back through Fort Worth because of where the rails are in this country. In order to get the waste to Yucca Mountain, they would pass back through Fort Worth, back through Oklahoma, and all of those communities in that stretch of the tracks anyway, would be seeing Maine Yankees shipments passing back through for the second time. And it shows the absurdity of consolidated interim storage, which is doubling transport risks for no good reason for a city like Fort Worth, which is standing up, joining our legal appeals with this friend of the court filing. So the more cities like that that stand up for their own safety of their residents, the better. That's how we stopped Yucca Mountain. When we woke up enough of the country to join Nevada in its resistance, including on the floor of the United States House of Representatives, including on the floor of the US Senate, we lost those votes in 2002, but we did well enough to slow it down enough that when Obama came into office, working with Senator Reid from Nevada, the dump was defunded and essentially canceled, although it's on some kind of a zombie life support system. So we always have to be vigilant that they're going to try to bring it back, such as these consolidated interim storage facilities with complicity from the NRC, assuming that Yucca is going to be the ultimate geologic repository.
And even if they're only keeping Yucca alive as a legal fiction, it allows the two dumps down in West Texas and New Mexico to be labeled interim because there's something else to aim for as opposed to them being final, and that would impact the safety requirements of them being built. Let's shift this back to what the nuclear infrastructure or the anti-nuclear infrastructure, those of us who oppose nuclear might have in terms of lessons for them to know about what they're going to be facing. I mean, we just learned this morning that the train that derailed had already passed through Cleveland. The point you were making about the cities where the rails would be going through had already passed through Cleveland, which was only 76 miles away. And the failure was based on a problem with the rail car as opposed to anything with the tracks. So that accident could just as well have happened 76 miles earlier, and then it would have been an even bigger catastrophe. But in terms of the problems that they are going to continue to be facing, what do the residents, do you feel, need to be doing now to, first of all, document and following that, take care of themselves in the wake of having this disaster happen to them?
Again, I think back to Three Mile Islands, the folks who went in after all this official denial that there was any impact to anybody, not even a sprained ankle, an NPR reporter, like the animal deaths. Robert Del Tredici, his book, The People of Three Mile Island, documented with photographs, interviews with the farmers, large-scale animal deaths. A farm that had birds, thousands of birds died on this farm. And it may be because of their very intense metabolism. So whatever they're exposed to, it goes through their system very quickly, and they're so small in size that they can't handle it. The shock kills them. In that case, radioactivity. I mean, but what's it doing to humans, right? Bigger animals that we are with slower metabolisms. So right now we're hearing about chickens dying in Palestine. We're hearing about foxes and rabbits dying. Again, critters with high metabolisms and smaller body sizes. We've heard about the fish kills. Unfortunately, a lot of the people that live there are not living in, no, they're low income, not unlike Three Mile Island. And they don't really have the resources to get away. I mean, the train company is supposedly paying some their hotel bills or whatever. But people have been encouraged by the governor of Ohio to return to town, to return to their homes. It's almost like they just want to sweep it under the rug, declare it over, carry on, don't worry about it. Will there be follow-on health studies? Probably not. There often are not. I mean, there really wasn't at Three Mile Island, except for the efforts of individuals, often members of the public who are not even trained in the field, but they train themselves. And there are some professionals like Steve Wing found statistically significant cancer downwind of Three Mile Island in the very directions where the radioactivity would have gone after the meltdown. So what people need to do is protect themselves and their family as best they can. That's kind of challenging to do when you don't have much money. One would hope would go somewhere. Force the train company to help these people to relocate. Who wants to leave their home? That's heartbreaking, but for your health and for your safety, you might have to. Document everything you can. Don't let them tell you you're crazy, and stick together as a community as best you can. I mean, it was interesting that the town hall meeting in East Palestine, the train company didn't even show up. they're trying not to show up. They don't want to say anything that they can be held accountable for in court. It's interesting, again, this conflict between the governors of Ohio and Pennsylvania, kind of rare right there in itself, that officialdom is not speaking with one voice, because they try to oftentimes speak with one voice and meets this juggernaut of denial. But in this case, there are some officials speaking out that decisions that are being made are not wise ones in this circumstance.
We'll continue to keep an eye on that, as well as on the nuclear issues that you raise that are still being so hotly debated. For now, Kevin Camps, I want to thank you for being my guest on such short notice this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Kevin Camps. He is Radioactive Waste Watchdog for Beyond Nuclear. We'll have links up to Beyond Nuclear and to the book Kevin mentioned, The People of Three Mile Island, on our website, Nuclear Hot Seat, under this episode, number 609. And while you're there, look for the yellow opt-in box. If you haven't already, that's where you can sign up to get one email a week that contains a link to that week's episode and a brief summary of some of the other material in the show. This is one way that you can guarantee that you never miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. You'll find it at NuclearHotSeat.com under this episode, number 608.
Activists, shout out.
Award-winning veteran environmental reporter Carl Grossman is up to his usual excellence with his television program, Cable TV, Enviro Close-Up. In the most recent episode, he interviews Gordon Edwards, who is president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Dr. Edwards is an expert on nuclear technology, and he refutes the claims of the nuclear industry as it pushes its purportedly new and improved nuclear power plants, so-called advanced nuclear power plants, and specifically small modular nuclear reactors. We'll have a link up to the full program on the website. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, in cooperation with the Center for Peace, Hiroshima University, will hold a major youth summit in Hiroshima to bring together young people from countries around the world to challenge their leaders on policies that support nuclear weapons. The Hiroshima G7 Youth Summit will take place on April 25 through 27, at the Hiroshima University campus, and they are inviting young people around the world to apply. To learn more, we will have a link up on the website, along with a brief video that explains exactly what happens if a nuke is dropped and where Russia is most likely to drop theirs during a full-scale nuclear war. The 12th International Uranium Film Festival has selected the first films to be screened in Rio de Janeiro, May 18 to 28. It's an eclectic array showing the passion, attentiveness, follow-through, and unflagging determination of activists around the world who are fighting against nukes in their own backyard. We will have more on this in the coming weeks, and who knows, maybe there's a trip to Brazil in my future. And speaking of films, here's an exciting piece of information. Netflix has produced a drama series on the Fukushima disaster called The Days. It's set to be released globally in June of 2023, and they have released their first teaser for it. The series is comparable to HBO's limited series Chernobyl, which quickly became one of the most celebrated and viewed limited series of all time. If The Days is as good as Chernobyl, then Netflix subscribers will have a powerful series to watch, and those of us who oppose nuclear, especially the release of radioactive waters from Fukushima, currently scheduled for possibly as soon as late summer, will have another weapon in our arsenal against it. And it is with great sadness that we learned of the passing of Mary Osco in North St. Louis. Mary lived adjacent to Coldwater Creek and walked regularly in St. Sin Park, both of which have been found to be contaminated with radioactive atomic weapons waste left over from the Manhattan Project. Mary fought a long and hard battle against stage 4 lung cancer, which she had, though she never smoked. She was a fierce advocate for complete cleanup of the waste. I met Mary Osco in 2016 when I went to St. Louis to cover the Adams Next Door Symposium, which had as its featured speaker Dr. Helen Caldicott. I recorded a lengthy interview with Mary at the time and will present it in an upcoming Nuclear Hot Seat. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 21st, 2023. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, beyondnuclear.org, nears.org, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANW.org, thebulletin.org, netflix.com, washingtonpost.com, anl.gov, odessa-journal.com, msn.com, reneweconomy.com, moroccoworldnews.com, apnews.com, milwaukeeindependent.com, cowboystatedaily.com, theguardian.com, civilbeat.com, vice.com, mainichi.jp, tokyo-np.co.jp, the soul-dead cubicle drones who crank out propaganda for World Nuclear News, and the captured and compromised by the industry they're supposed to be regulating, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Our thanks to Linda Pence Gunter for the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. You can sign up for it at nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow box, put in your first name, doesn't even have to be your real first name, just something, and put in an email address that does have to be legit. And every week, we will send you one email with the link to that week's episode and a short description of the show's content. You will get it the split instant that it posts. If you prefer and you listen to podcasts a lot, go to your favorite podcast channel because we're there as well. We don't want you to miss a single episode. Now here's a call for your participation. You're where you are. You see the nuclear story, and maybe I do, but maybe I don't. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything you can do, we will appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023. Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, and if you care to, the name of the guests and me. This is Libby Halevi, producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you once again that we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with the date that it's over, because once it starts, it's never over. That's it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
What have those boys been drinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.